Hello, I'm Claire Barber and I head up Client Service Marketing and Communications for Aurum Research Limited. And I'm joined by Emily Forsyth Davis from Aurum Research Limited, who's the head of ESG. And we're going to be talking about some of the output from the recent COP27 and specifically focused on the conversations around climate justice. And then we're going to be sharing with you a recent discussion between Emily and Catherine Bryan, who's a trustee at a charity called Synchronicity Earth that Aurum has worked with to build regeneration portfolios. And that discussion actually touched on some of the issues raised at COP27, so we felt it was a really good time to be able to share that with you more widely. But I'll let Emily tell you more about that in a second. But first of all, let's say hello and welcome to Emily. Emily, do you want to just introduce yourself for the listeners that may not know you or your background?
Of course. Thanks so much, Claire. So my role as head of ESG at Aurum Research Limited encompasses investment, corporate and our philanthropic approach. And for those of you who don't know, I'm also an actuary by background, so have a real risk management mindset.
Thanks, Emily. And as I said, one of the reasons we're talking today is one of the focus areas of COP27 is actually social justice and bringing to the agenda some of the key issues that have actually often been overlooked when companies and countries look to increase their green credentials.
Exactly, Claire. And I think this whole idea of social justice, climate justice and the just transition really used to be thought of as a niche idea. But as we head into COP27, it's really creeping up the agenda, and the loss and damage concerns of developing economies are really starting to be taken more seriously in the global approach to avoiding climate catastrophe.
Exactly, yeah. And the fact they're on the agenda and everybody's talking about them, that's going to create a focus and an awareness. And that focus and awareness will drive positive momentum, I think, in those areas. I've got a quick question, though, which is just how does this conversation or the conversations we're talking about that are happening at COP27, how does that relate to investors and specifically investors in alternative investments?
So I think it's really something that should be in all of our mindsets, is what we do and how this can relate to things. So a key area for this would be carbon offsetting or carbon balancing that a lot of alternative investment managers do. And it's really important that when you're looking for a program that is undertaking the carbon removal for you, that you look at a holistic approach and making sure it's benefiting communities. And this is not only because it's sort of the right thing to do, but also projects like this will not be successful unless they are backed by the local community and therefore benefit the local community.
Thanks very much, Emily. That brings us really nicely to your discussions with Catherine. So do you want to just introduce that?
Exactly. So I was lucky enough to be joined by Catherine Bryan, who is a trustee at Synchronicity Earth, who are an environmental charity, earlier in the year. And she's a real expert in carbon balancing and carbon offsetting. So it was fantastic to hear her thoughts and opinions on this somewhat controversial area. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Catherine Bryan, who is a trustee at Synchronicity Earth. For those of you who don't know Catherine, she has a background in the finance sector and focuses on how markets can work to produce positive environmental outcomes. Over the last 6 months, Catherine has been working with the Synchronicity Earth team to further develop their More Than Carbon initiative, focusing on supporting local organisations. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Emily. It's really nice to be here to talk about what's a very knotty subject for lots of people, the carbon credits market.
So I think one thing that we should touch on first is, why are we talking about carbon? As you've said, it's a knotty subject, but why is it so high up the agenda?
Well, none of us can have gone around our everyday lives and not noticed the fact that we have a climate emergency. You'll be aware that the Paris Climate Accord a number of years ago created a global agreement that set objectives, long-term objectives, to reduce carbon emissions. So we're trying to get to net zero emissions by 2050. And to do that, we need to halve emissions by 2030. That's not very far away. And at the moment, our emissions, global emissions, are still growing. So we really need to increase action to reduce emissions.
So what is the sort of difference between the terminology in this area? So I hear a lot of things about credits and offsets, mandatory offsets. voluntary carbon markets? What's sort of the terminology and how does that work in practice?
Well, the mandatory markets were created in different countries over the last few years, really targeting the high energy use sectors. So these are sectors where effectively emissions are regulated and a limited amount of credits are issued to those sectors. And the intention is that over time, the amount issued are reduced so that the emissions of those sectors have to reduce. And I think there are mixed views on how effective that's been. But it is a regulated way of trying to shift emissions and reduce emissions in the really high intensity sectors. Now, beyond those sectors, companies can use the voluntary markets. So that's where they are choosing to seek to offset or reduce emissions by accessing projects that can avoid or sequester carbon. But I think here the really important point is that the first thing people should be tackling is really trying to assess their carbon footprint, putting together a plan for how they're going to actually reduce emissions over a period of time. And they will be left with a bit of carbon that you really just can't avoid. And therefore, it is really important then to try and do something to mitigate that remaining footprint. And that's where the voluntary carbon markets should be a route to do that. However, as we all know, I think many people have questions about the transparency and effectiveness of those markets. But really, as I said, the most important thing, first of all, is to make sure you've really understood where your carbon emissions are and how you can reduce them.
Great. And I think that's a really important point because realistically, everyone's going to continue to have some carbon emissions. And so it's about taking steps to understand where you are and then what you need to do about it. And I think for some people, it can feel very overwhelming to be at the start of the journey, and therefore they can avoid sort of push off starting a journey. Whereas actually, even just taking that first step of thinking about what carbon you can calculate, what you are aware of as far as your emissions go, will be a fantastic improvement on not having anything in place.
I completely agree. And we know that there are lots of different parts of your business or in your personal life where you will have a carbon footprint. It's really important to look at full life cycle. So if you think about food, it's from the point where a seed is planted all the way through to waste, actually. But there are carbon models available to look at emissions in all aspects of our lives. And I'd stress these are models. It's not always an exact science, but it is certainly better to actually do what you can to understand the impacts you can rather than avoid it because it's not quite perfect. It's better to do as much as you can to actually understand the footprint you have.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the point, isn't it? That you need to start somewhere, and because of the requirement to move to net zero for the whole economy, really taking action today is critical. So as I've sort of mentioned and we've touched on, credits and offsets, what's the difference?
I think nowadays those terms are often really interchangeable. Credits initially were the terminology used for the mandatory markets. Within the voluntary markets, as I said, people talk about credits and offsets in an interchangeable way. There have been, in the voluntary markets, a number of organisations who have created frameworks and standards for those markets. So I'm talking about organisations like Plan Vivo, Vera, the Gold Standard. And voluntary markets can cover a really wide range of strategies to avoid or actually store carbon. So that can be anything from renewable energy projects Or something like efficient cook stoves in places like Africa. One of the biggest drivers of deforestation is harvesting wood for charcoal to cook. So providing really efficient cook stoves that use really much reduced amounts of charcoal is really important, and they have really important additional benefits. The health benefits are enormous because many women spend a lot of hours tending fires and have respiratory problems because of that. So like many of these projects, they often have other benefits, and it is really exploring some of those other benefits which can be quite important, so thinking of them holistically. And then there are obviously the nature-based solutions. So that people tend to think immediately of planting trees. And obviously trees are a fantastic store of carbon. But it's really important to think about where they're planted, what sort of species are planted, and what the long-term plans are for that piece of woodland, to really understand whether it's going to be a long-term store. And I think one of the things that you mentioned up front was the voluntary markets. There is a real lack of transparency currently. So there are many actors involved in them, from the frameworks that look at accreditation and verification of projects, all the way through to brokers who intermediate to introduce buyers to sellers. And that does mean that there is often not as much as you may think that gets from the purchase price actually onto the ground to the local project. And one of the things I think that really needs to happen is more transparency on that front. And that's one of the reasons why Synchronicity Earth has done work to really think about how we direct some flows through to local organisations who really struggle to actually access these markets. These markets, the voluntary markets, really do produce some fantastic projects that are doing really important ecosystem restoration and sequestering carbon. But for smaller organisations, those different costs that they have to incur to be part of those markets really take out too much of the potential income for them. And it also requires a level of staff capacity and skill set that they may not have available. Often the small organisations really run on a shoestring to achieve the outcomes they want to. So our approach is that for many of the organisations we fund, we feel it's better to continue a philanthropic approach where we know all the money that we receive from donors gets through to the project on the ground. And it's been really great working with Aurum over the past few years, who funded Hutan, which is a project in Malaysia. And I know, Emily, one of the reasons they did that, or you have done that, is because of the challenges, I suppose, in the carbon markets.
Exactly. And I think one of the points that you succinctly raised there, Catherine, was about the amount of funding that's actually going into conservation. So with some carbon credits, it can be as little as 25% of the cost of the carbon credit. And realistically, that is not enough to fund high quality conservation. And so we think, as a business, it's really important to ensure that we're not only helping to sequester carbon, but also benefiting the local community and benefiting biodiversity. And therefore, carbon credits, with their lack of transparency, didn't really work for us as an organisation. And I think that sort of leads on to another point around carbon being seen as an investment opportunity. Now, clearly, as a head of ESG at a hedge fund allocator, I've had a number of conversations about carbon as an investment. However, there can really be an issue with an alignment of values when you're purchasing carbon credits, because of the lack of transparency which you've cited, it can be difficult to know that you're funding programs which are having an overall net positive outcome. And also there have been issues around carbon credits not necessarily doing what people expect. And so that alignment of values and purchasing carbon credits can be problematic in the industry. And therefore it means that having this extra layer of transparency that we have with Hutan and funding the Hutan More Than Carbon project really works for us as a business. And I think within the wider point of ensuring there's no nasty surprises in your supply chain, it's also important to ensure there's no nasty surprises when you're looking at carbon offsetting, because the last thing you want to do when you're doing something good is to find out that actually you're doing something bad.
I think these are really good points, and I'm sure things a lot of people listening will be tackling themselves. I think what we've found in our work with local organisations is that many of them actually are sceptical of carbon markets. They really see actually the environmental degradation and the climate issues that we're trying to tackle now have been driven very much by an economic system that has failed to take into account environmental impacts. And their view is it won't just take a bit of a bolt on to actually address this. It needs much deeper cultural change, much deeper change within our economic system. And I feel I have to agree with them on that this by itself is not the solution. But actually, I think done well, it can be an important pathway in terms of our transition to a more regenerative economy. And I think the really interesting thing about Hutan, so just to let listeners know, this is an organization that works in Borneo, Malaysian Borneo, and it works right in the middle of palm oil plantations along a river. And you still have some pockets of forest along that river and some areas of some protected areas. But those protected areas are separated by palm oil plantation. And so what Hutan's been doing over a number of years is trying to reconnect those areas of forest. And that is so important to really support the local wildlife. When you get these pockets, these islands of wildlife, long-term, those are not sustainable. So what they've done is they have worked with local communities to set up nurseries. So the nurseries are run often by women in the communities who grow saplings of local trees. Hutan then pays for those saplings. It plants them, and their planting team are local as well. And I think the really lovely thing there is over the years, that planting team moved from being all male to now mostly female. And it's provided a job to local women. It's helped give them a voice within their communities, and they have an important income. And they're planting up areas of palm oil that have been bought that they are now using to link up these areas of protected forest. And we're already beginning to see the wildlife use those corridors. Luckily in the tropics, you have really fast growth rates. And they monitor very closely the success of the trees they plant. But we're already seeing animals moving through those corridors. But those corridors won't be fully mature for another 20 or 30 years. But it is interesting to see how quickly things bounce back if you have the right plan for them. So Hutan is a great example of a local organisation which has a long-term vision of really protecting and restoring what is there and trying to regenerate systems to improve the local landscape and wildlife. And the funding that Aurum has been able to provide has enabled them to move very significantly on their journey to delivering that vision.
And I think the HUTAM project has been amazing. It's been really wonderful to work with. And also, I'd just like to add that there is actually an elephant who moves through the corridor now, Celeste. And if you want to read more about her, then have a look at the impact report. So I think one thing that I've really noticed when I've been doing research on carbon, and this is mainly Googling, by the way, is the vested interest and the fact it's really hard to get objective information. So I wondered, Catherine, if you'd be able to sort of cover the key things to watch out for when you're looking into carbon.
Yes, well, this comes back again to this transparency issue. I think the interesting thing is working in financial markets, we're used to these days that you have to provide transparency on fees in lots of different parts of the financial markets. At the moment, many of the platforms which offer carbon credits, one, don't give all the pricing, so you can't compare pricing easily between different projects. And there's certainly no clarity on, as you say, how much of what you give actually gets to the project on the ground. But then the other issues are, again, like any market, there are different qualities of credits. As I said, some carbon credits will be incredibly well, the projects themselves will be incredibly well thought through, very well planned and executed. And there should be clear differentiation within the market to demonstrate which projects do have that real level of expertise and clarity of execution compared to those which are not so well thought through. And thinking about this long-term objectives, you also want to understand the broader impacts. We're very much talking about carbon here, but particularly when it comes to nature-based solutions, everything has a wider impact. So you won't just have an impact on the carbon in an ecosystem. You will also impact the species which live within that system if you change the environment. We also know from conservation science over many years that long-term positive results only come when you really have the support and involvement of the people that live in the area in which you're active. So without really understanding the impacts on biodiversity, without understanding how local communities are involved, you're only looking at a very single dimension of any project. And it's not always, that information is not always available. And so that's information you should be asking for. And don't be shy to ask. If people can't answer questions about biodiversity impacts and about social impact, then they're probably not the right people you should be having a discussion with. This whole approach of really thinking in a more holistic manner is going to be important in every aspect of what we do around ESG and environment. But I think it's particularly important in the carbon markets that we don't just look at one-dimensional carbon figures and carbon objectives, that we're really looking at broader environmental and social objectives.
And I think that's a great point. Really, carbon offsets or carbon credits or whatever you want to call them don't really solve the overall problem. That, as you've mentioned, carbon emissions are still rising. There are significant global issues with biodiversity and Indigenous people's land rights. And so I think it would be useful to understand what carbon offsets can and what they can't achieve.
Yes, I think the language itself can often be a bit of a hurdle. Offset makes all of us feel that if we do one activity and then we buy an offset, we've perfectly matched that activity. That really doesn't work. What we can do is, I think, recognize the impact of an activity that causes a carbon and an environmental impact, and then look at the best way to balance that. Because we are talking about actions possibly in different places through different mechanisms. So absolutely, we need to do as much as we can to reduce carbon emissions. So I think there you need to think about what's the best way of balancing a particular activity in terms of location, in terms of method, in terms of approach. But don't think of it as a perfect equation. We're not in a world here, as we taught before, which is an exact science. And I think if you can take the approach where if you're always trying to produce a solution that creates as much positive outcome as you can, you're more likely to get it right. So don't ever look for just perfect offset. Always look for the most you can do, because then you're most likely to have an outcome that really is going to have an impact on carbon in terms of reductions, but also a really positive impact for people and for planet.
Exactly. And as a sort of actuary by background, I think that really resonates with me, because there is no perfect solution. This is not a black and white situation, but there are steps you can take to get the best positive outcome available. And through time, you can continue to develop that. And this isn't a look at this once and this problem will be resolved, but it's an iterative process that companies and people need to go through in order to drive positive change.
No, exactly. And I've no doubt, actually, in 5 years' time, these markets are going to look quite different. And I think in 5 years' time, companies are going to have far more tools available to them to really understand their impacts. But don't let that stop you doing things now. We really need urgent action. And there are many choices out there. You know, as we've discussed at Synchronicity Earth, we felt the philanthropic route was a route that's proven so that you can really have conservation impact. But there are, as I said, there are some very good projects available through voluntary markets if you put the research in.
Excellent. So I know this is a topic really close to your heart and one that people probably have read about, nature-based solutions. You know, what does a good nature-based carbon solution look like?
Well, as we talked about earlier, I think people immediately think about trees. We know that as they grow, trees sequester carbon very effectively. But first of all, trees need to be planted in the right place. There are some landscapes around the whole world, you know, in the UK and across the world, where trees are a great solution. Ideally, we'd be looking for native trees, so that you are trying to regenerate an ecosystem which will work hand in hand with local species. But there are lots of landscapes where you would certainly not want to plant trees. You know, and an error we particularly have made in this country in the past is planting trees on peatlands. So I think there has been a lot more focus recently on the importance of peatlands, particularly in this country. The UK actually has globally important peat. So peatlands are places that store huge amounts of carbon. You really need a high water table to make sure that carbon stays sequestered in the peat. And obviously planting a tree on that removes water and you start emitting carbon. And there are lots of initiatives in the UK at the moment to try and really restore our carbon. And it's not just peatlands, it's other wetlands, it's coastal ecosystems. So we know that coastal ecosystems actually could be a really important solution going forward, whether it's regenerating seagrass beds or regenerating mangrove in the tropics. And again, there are often just massive other benefits around this. Both of those, you know, mangroves and seagrass support lots of other species. And we also now know mangroves are incredibly good protection for coastal communities for storm. So there are lots and lots of nature-based solutions that we should be looking at, not just trees. And as I said, within this country, you know that peat is a priority for us. There's also been a big emphasis on woodland, on replanting woodland. But I'd also emphasise that all of us, if we have a phone, if we have a computer, if we eat exotic fruits, we've got supply chains that reach all over the world. So again, we need to be very cognizant of the impact we have beyond the shores of this country.
And thank you, Catherine. It's been wonderful to chat, and I really enjoyed especially talking about peatlands. Being from Somerset originally, our peatlands have had a lot of issues over the years, and they're just not as glamorous as the rainforest or, you know, beautiful coastal areas, or perhaps even the Scottish woodland conversations that have been happening. But it's definitely a very important point that we don't need to focus just on the things that we can see or the things that look most beautiful in a photograph, but actually things that are on our doorstep, and to think more holistically about what we're doing and what impact that's having. And so thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily. It was a pleasure.
Well, that was certainly interesting, and I certainly learnt a few new things from that, even though obviously I've been aware of Synchronicity Earth's work for some time, given the fact that Orem work with them so closely. And I hope everybody that's listening that you found it as interesting and, you know, perhaps enlightening as I did. And a really big thanks to Catherine for giving us her time. For anyone listening that wants to find out a bit more about the work that Synchronicity Earth do, or specifically the regeneration portfolios, you can find out more on their website in the More Than Carbon section. And the website is synchronicityearth.org. So that's synchronicityearth.org. And if you want to find out more about Orem's approach to ESG, then you can visit the ESG page on the orem.com website.
So thank you very much for your time today, Claire. And obviously it was wonderful talking to Catherine. If anyone has any questions or any feedback they'd like to give us, it would be wonderful to hear from you at esg@orem.com. That's esg@orem.com. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.